My mom and her butt buddies are booty calling Baphomet, and we're gonna hide in here like scared little bitches because they can turn your liver into fire ants. If they find us, they're not going to kill us. They're gonna do shit that you can't comprehend. And they're not going to stop until you're strapped naked to a barbed wire altar with a 15-foot beast of Gehenna and his double-pronged demon dong walking out of your coot chute like it's a revolving door of ground beef.
To the suspicious. As always, I'm Lindsay Wilkins. And this week, we are still with Brian De Palma, and we are putting a Rebecca Romijn twist on it with a double of Chelsea Stardust's Satanic Panic and, of course, De Palma's Femme Fatale, The Witch and the Fatale. And here with me is one of the greats. He's the editor and chief of the host of F This Movie. It is, of course, Patrick Bromley. Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm good. Thank you so much for coming on. I've been doing all these sort of Brian De Palma movies, and I thought, well, I kind of know another Brian De Palma fan, which is you. You've talked about a lot of how you like his movies. So thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm a huge Brian De Palma fan, and I'm very excited to talk about these movies with you.
Yes, rewatching them, I was just having so much fun, and just the gleefulness of both movies. So this is going to be an amazing, amazing double. How is F This Movie going? I'm guessing you're right in the thick of the pre-scary movie month happening at the moment. It's coming up very quickly, even though it's more than a month.
I know. Yeah, it is. It comes up so fast. As soon as August hits, I start to shift and I'm like, oh, I start watching a lot more horror and I start really getting myself ready for scary movie month. So I'm very excited about it this year.
No, me too. It always sort of starts happening around the same year. I'm just like, oh, I really want to watch horror and get back into it. And then I realize, oh, wait, it's literally the run up. And then it's like one of the best times of the year.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, before we get into the double, you've already said you're a huge Brian De Palma fan. Do you remember when you first saw one of his movies?
I think I had seen a couple of his movies as a youth, without necessarily, like, I saw The Untouchables and maybe something else without really realizing, like, at that point, I think I wasn't fully aware of, like, what a director was or who directors were of movies that I was watching. It wasn't really until, I want to say, when I was in high school, I went and rented Body Double, like, specifically because I wanted to see this movie and I knew it was directed by Brian De Palma. And I watched it and it spoke to me in a way that movies hadn't before. And I became very aware of, like, the director's choices and how he moves the camera and how he edits things together. And it's really one of the movies responsible for sort of transforming how I look at movies, because I do tend to look at them through the filmmaker, as opposed to, like, the actor or the genre or whatever. And so from there, it was like all bets were off. And then I just consumed as much De Palma as I could.
He has a habit of doing that when you start realizing that he is, and you start realizing his technique and how way he moves the camera and all that kind of thing. Going back and, say, watching The Untouchables after you sort of realized, oh, this is De Palma, how did that movie change?
I mean, you could definitely see his fingerprints on it. This is not my observation at all. I remember years ago, Quentin Tarantino was giving an interview on Charlie Rose, and he talked about De Palma and he talked about The Untouchables. And he said it's one of the few examples where a filmmaker's aesthetic perfectly aligns with, like, a commercial Hollywood aesthetic. So it's this sort of mass appeal blockbuster mainstream movie, but you can still tell that it's a Brian De Palma movie. It doesn't sacrifice. And he ends up doing that again, I think, with Mission Impossible. I think he manages to pull it off twice. So I like The Untouchables, but I tend to like his slightly more offbeat personal kind of thrillers, like the one we're talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. I would totally go with Mission Impossible because he knows how to blend the two sensibilities. But then when we'll get into it with Femme Fatale, all bets are off and he's just going full blurred lines. I think just everything. Yeah, it's a kind of incredible. But yeah, he's one of those filmmakers that really makes you, because he's just focusing in on that, the technique, which is, yeah, kind of why I actually thought I'd seen Femme Fatale. And then I was sort of watching it, and I was like going, I don't think I've seen all of Femme Fatale before. This is absolutely amazing. So this was an absolutely treat for me to get to actually finally sit down and watch it. Oh, I just want to give credit to Daniel Epler from Cobwebs, who actually suggested this double. So thank you, Daniel. This was a blast.
Thank you, Daniel. Yeah, yes. I'm so excited. This was your first time viewing of this movie.
Yeah, I thought I had seen it. Like, I think I've caught some of it on TV, and then I was sitting down to watch it going, oh, I don't think I've seen all of this. I definitely do not remember those diamonds in that can't seen.
Very memorable.
Yes, very, very memorable. But with that, we're going to get into another memorable movie that I didn't think I was going to have as much fun with. So what then? I sat down and watched Satanic Panic and went, oh, this is one of the best. This is an amazing movie. I should watch this more often, even though it just come out. But I'm like, yay, now this is in my life. And we're going to be getting into Satanic Panic.
The tips. 4 hours, my total earnings are an expired Applebee's coupon. A sweater that smells like racism.
It's exactly your size.
Oh. Deliver for meal basin.
It's outside our zone.
I'll do it.
Are you ready to make an investment in your future?
Yes.
Are you ready to take back what you are owed?
Yes.
Are you ready to fully commit yourself to Satan?
Yes!
Who are you?
I'm the pizza guy. A girl?
Are you by any chance a virgin?
That's a very personal question.
She's a virgin.
Oh. Whose power unlocks our true potential?
Hail Satan!
Do you have any idea what's happening here tonight?
Hail Satan!
They are summoning Baphomet, a big demon from hell. And when that clock strikes 12, he is gonna rip you open.
Where's my virgin?
I don't know what's happening. My mom and her butt buddies are booty calling Baphomet.
Hail Satan!
And they're not going to stop until you're strapped to a barbed wire altar. That's bonkers. No, I know this movie was doing all the festival circuits around 2018, 2019. Did you see it during a festival run or was it after that?
I did. I was fortunate enough to see it. There was an unfortunately short-lived horror festival in Chicago that ran for maybe 5 years called Cinepocalypse, and COVID ended up kind of killing it. But Satanic Panic did play there, and Chelsea came out to introduce it. And that's kind of where I got to meet her, and we're somewhat friendly now. And she's been on my podcast a couple of times, and she's really, really terrific.
She is, and I really enjoy those episodes because she has a really cool insight into movies. Yeah, I saw this at Melbourne's Monster Fest. It was it was literally, I think, a movie in between something that I was waiting to see, and then that ended up being the highlight of the night, which is always the best way of doing it. But it is such a surprising light and dark tone at the same time, which I really, really love, especially when you get Rebecca Romijn's head cult witch Satanist, who, I don't know, after watching it this time, I'm like, no, actually, this is one of those cults I'd kind of probably join. She's actually she's really good.
She's, this is the kind of movie that you watch her in, and you're like, oh, between this and Femme Fatale, honestly, these are probably her two best performances, I think, and obviously we'll talk about Femme Fatale later, but you know, she's probably most known for, like, besides modeling, for her X-Men stuff, in terms of her movie work, but you watch Satanic Panic and you're like, I kind of wish she had a bigger career as an actor, because she's really fun in this movie.
She is really fun, and she steals every scene she's in. And this is a kind of a movie where you have a whole bunch of scene stealers. I mean, I'm probably going to butcher her name, but Arden Myron is amazing in it as this kind of sidekick who's just trying to undermine her at every single point. Is incredible in it. And that's not to mention the lead, Hayley Griffith. But whenever Rebecca's on screen, you're just like, yeah, this is absolutely a woman who would run a multifaceted corporate satanic cult. And she's not going to take any, and she needs a virgin. She's going to get a virgin.
Yeah, right. I love Jerry O'Connell's one scene in this movie too. Just all the choices he makes with the little goatee and the vaping and everything he does. He just plays such a good douchebag.
He is the ultimate douchebag, and especially when he's attacking poor Hayley Griffith, who still doesn't quite understand what's happening, saying, I'm trying to save you, is both dark and hilarious at the same time. No, this yeah. movie's filled with those kind of little one scenes. I mean, even Clark Wolf's sex worker who's in need of peers. I love that little moment. It's kind of adorable. Just to set up Satanic Panic, it is this movie of this pizza delivery girl on her first night who is not doing well with the tips. So she finally loses it and then finds herself in a satanic ritual that's trying to bring back Baphomet. And then the insanity kind of ensues. It's kind of one of those, it kind of reminded me a lot of those great like 1970s satanic movies, like a little bit of like Satan's Cheerleaders or Devil's Reign, The Burbs mm-hmm. especially. But I even got like a little bit of Society thrown in there, but just without the shunting.
The only thing this movie was missing.
Exactly. I mean, that's what I was thinking. If this had a good shunting scene, that this movie would have been perfect.
We get close. I mean, there's kind of an orgy scene near the end, but it's not a full-on shunt.
No. And I thought all very wealthy satanic cults had to have a shunt orgy at the end. Oh, I remember seeing Society at like this marathon thing. And just that when that happened, you could just feel the crowd just like, I'm sorry, what now?
Yeah, that's during a marathon. That's wild, because that's a hard movie to recover from. Like, I'd hate to be the movie that has to follow Society.
Yeah, I think I went home after Society because I think I can't remember what movie it was. I know I'd seen it. I'm like, you know what? This is the perfect note to end on. I'm going.
Yeah, I think you made the right call.
Yeah, I think I did. But it's just this very fun, insane, kind of goopy kind of movie filled with these amazing character actors and also really great indie horror actors. I mean, I completely forgot that Jeff Daniel Phillips shows up with his goatee or beard, AJ Bowen, Ruby Modine, who I hope gets more roles because she's always amazing in everything I've seen her. And of course, Jerry O'Connell being the douchiest vaping guy sitting on a couch I've ever seen.
It's one of these horror comedies. You know, horror comedy is a little bit hard to pull off, I think, because the movies tend to sort of lean heavily one way or the other. And while I would say this one definitely leans way more comedy than horror, it never sacrifices on the horror, and there are things that happen that are genuinely, as you pointed out, dark, that are genuinely shocking, that are genuinely gross and upsetting. I mean, again, I'm thinking of Rebecca Romijn sort of jamming her fist into Jerry O'Connell's neck. So, you know, Chelsea Stardust, she never sacrifices the horror for the sake of a laugh, even though, you know, the movie is pretty silly a lot of the times. I think she finds a really good balance here.
She does. And speaking of Rebecca Romijn putting a fist in Jared Connor's throat to pull out his heart, it's a really disgusting scene and doesn't, and you're just fully in that horror moment. And then she tells her assistant to put it in a pan, not the good pan, and cook it, which kind of is a really nice, it doesn't take away from the horror moment, but it just puts a really nice button on it. Which this movie does constantly. Even then it'll have those big emotional moments. Like, I love the scene where Ruby Modine is being voodoo dolled. I don't exactly what the term is, Right. But then she has to skin seal. So she has to try and get Hayley Griffith to actually come to the moment, stand up, and actually keep riding on her skin, even though all these insane things are happening to her. Like, I completely forgot about the pins coming out of her face and the vomiting of worms, which is always great to see in a horror movie.
I was watching it with Erica, and she was getting very upset at everything that was happening on screen, because she just has not been in a horror place lately. And she was, I'm tired of seeing people throwing up in movies. And she was getting very upset.
No, I could imagine. It probably wasn't the best idea then to follow it up with Fulci's City of the Dead.
Right. Which gets a very nice shout out for the, during the whole AJ Bowen sequence.
Oh, absolutely. This movie had that kind of feel to it. Like, as soon as, yeah, the worms and that AJ Bowen having his intestines just pulled out of his mouth, like, oh gosh, Rebecca Mayne's so great. I just love her. She's like, come on, it's okay. Come on. And just pulling out the intestines is great, but it's a little nice Fulci reference, which kind of made me, this is kind of this weird of, it's not a spoof. It's not kind of, there's just references, but it feels like this amazing accompaniment of that satanic genre, even though Stardust manages to keep everything so original, which is really impressive to sort of go, yes, I know the genre I'm working in. You will see it, but I'm keeping this movie very, very original. And it's almost like it feels just as new as it is as referencing other movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had said, I feel like in her introduction to the movie when I saw it back in, I think, 2019, that this was her goal was to make the kind of horror movie that could best be enjoyed at like a sleepover for 15-year-old girls. And I was like, yeah, she kind of nailed that.
She really did. And it's actually surprising how hard it is for that 15-year-old slumber party movie to be pulled off. I know Kevin Smith tried to make it with Yoga Hosen.
Yeah.
And there's a few other movies that I think tried to capture that, and it doesn't quite work. But I totally wish I had this movie when I was 15 and watching movies, because it's a really great introduction into that genre. And then you're like, right, okay, now I'm ready for Devil's Reign. Now I'm ready for City of the Dead. Bring it on. To put you on the spot, do you have any other favorite satanic kind of movies, or was it just this movie? Is it just this movie just tends to be one of your favorite because it's really good?
Yeah, I think it's more the execution that that I really like rather than the genre, because I find myself not super into like devil worship movies. Mm. House of the Devil would be up there. I'm trying to pull up a list now because I'm trying to remember some other, like, you know, it kind of casts a wide net, because if you're going to call something like Prince of Darkness a satanic horror movie, I mean, that's got the devil is a green liquid in a jar.
It does.
But that would be one for me. Mm. You already mentioned The Devil's Reign, which is a great, crazy movie. Mm. But I don't tend to Race with the Devil is a really good one. Mm. But the whole, you know, I've talked about this before enough, this movie, I'm not super into like religious horror. And satanic worship horror movies are sort of a subset of that. Not quite, but like they have a lot in common. And so I don't necessarily seek them out. So I feel like it's more the tone and the execution of Satanic Panic rather than the genre in which it exists that keeps me coming back to it.
Yeah, I have a weird thing with cult horror movies. I don't know why. I was never particularly brought up in a religious household or anything like that. And I don't love religious horror, but for some reason you get a group of people worshiping a thing and I'm like, oh yeah, I'll check that out. sure, why not? But no, there's something about the execution with Satanic Panic that takes all the any nervousness people would have about it, the devil worship, away, because Rebecca Romijn is just killing it in this movie, literally, and everyone in this movie. But she does this the same in Femme Fatale, as we'll get into, but she's got this kind of cold veneer, but you can tell things are happening. She doesn't, she's acting cold, but she doesn't feel cold. So the scene when she's kind of confronting her daughter, played by Ruby Modine, who I just found out is actually the Matthew Modine's daughter. I was like, what? I just thought they had the same name. And she's trying to be a mother, even though she has no patience for it. And just with that, with the opening, great opening of someone walking into this very nice house, and then you finding Ruby having sex for the first time because she's kind of realized what's about to happen to her. It's kind of this great dynamic. And I think she pulls it off really well. Again, she's, yeah, acting cold, but isn't cold. She's, I don't know. It's I wish she had a bigger career as well, because I think she can pull off that dynamic really well. And she's just, you can't stop looking at her when she's on screen.
Yeah, she absolutely commands every moment that she's in both of these movies, and in pretty much everything I've seen her in, which again is fairly limited. She's been in some movies that I haven't seen, I know. Obviously, part of that is just she's a supermodel. She's very striking, but it goes beyond just her physical stature. It has everything to do with the way that she composes herself. Particularly in Femme Fatale, because that entire movie is really built around her, you know.
Very much.
Satanic Panic, she's kind of slotted into a specific type of role, and yet you watch it and you're like, oh, I can't really think of anybody who would have done that better. You know, the way that, as you said, she is believable as somebody who would run the show. Like, yeah, I would listen to whatever she said. I would do whatever she told me to do. I would follow her into the literal depths of hell, because she's so commanding, and really funny without, you know, she's never going for laughs in Satanic Panic, but she's very much in on the joke, which I think really helps.
It really is. That kind of feels like the whole thing, though. No one is actually really going for the joke, except for maybe O'Connell. Yeah. But that's just kind of that one great kind of scene where he knows just where to, how to lie on the couch just to make it work. But everyone's kind of feeling the emotion of the moment, even when they're being silly. But it's, yeah, and this movie does go to the depths of hell, and Chelsea Stardust always knows it has to be true to Hayley Greta. So when she's in labor with Beth Amet and everything's going to go completely crazy and she's doing her two fluffy bunnies mantra, that's the first thing you see. And it's just like, oh, because this is her character. She's sweet. She wants to have all this optimism, even though she's surrounded by all the most cynical, awful people on the planet. She still has that kind of, she has that positivity. She wants the world to be good. And the fact that the Code of the Sams came back, I completely forgot that came back. That was a brilliant callback.
Sam's Helping Sams. That's my jam.
Yeah, Sam's Helping Sams, which is kind of what the movie ends up being about, which I love. And then the fact that she called her bunny Judy Jr. was the best.
I like that they give her that backstory too, because I don't, you know, it's not necessarily required. There's enough of a character on the page in terms of being sweet and innocent and optimistic, as you pointed out, and just being the wrong, you know, the character who's in the wrong place at the wrong time. But then they give her the backstory about feeling like she had abandoned her friend when they were both going through cancer treatment, and just that she's been through such hardship and yet retains this optimism. Really fleshes out her character in an interesting way. And I know the script is by Grady Hendrix, who's a really terrific writer. I haven't read all of his stuff, but I've read some of his books, and he's a really good writer. And I like the subtlety of that characterization.
No, it's, I do as well. She's really fleshed out, and you understand why she's choosing every moment that she does. But also, with a lot of these movies, as soon as there's like a virgin sacrifice, it's always the biggest joke that this person's still a virgin. But because they give her the cancer backstory and the fact that she has gone through all this horrible and hard things in her life, it's completely understandable that this is where she is. And it's not a thing to take advantage for. The movie doesn't let everyone take advantage of it, even though they are trying to, because she's going to be sacrificed. But at the same time, it's, Yeah, and it kind of gives her the strength, which I really like. It wasn't the, it's not like Hocus Pocus where every 5 minutes it's the joke about the virgin with like a 14-year-old. And I'm like, that guys, just give him a few years. And calm down. But it's, yeah, it was a nice way of doing it. And it gave her this backstory and it gave her, you understood her very, very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I just also with the virgin thing, it kind of, there was also that social, well, this movie is very much the social satire, I guess, of the wealthy just praying to the devil so they could rule the world. But it was kind of interesting, I just, me overthinking things with Judy having to go through the purity club so she could stay a virgin to be sacrificed was just this whole big thing of why they have that in the first place. It's, you know, to be pure. It's like, oh, because that's what they're doing. They're sacrificing it to the devil, not the thing. I quite like that little twist on the whole purity ring thing. It made me smile.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about Satanic Panic before we move on to the main event?
I think it's a really good warm-up for Femme Fatale, because you get some Rebecca Romijn, but she's not the whole show. And then Femme Fatale, she really takes over.
She really, really does. And that is a really good point. It is a really good warm-up. If you haven't seen it, it is so brilliant. I mean, Rebecca Romijn kind of rules everything, and all the men in this movie, she completely rules. I mean, from Jerry O'Connell to Daniel Phillips to AJ Bowen, she kind of rules them all. It's such a... yeah, that's what I said. I would join this cult because I'd go, yeah, she's kind of in control of everything. Even when she loses control, she's like, okay, well, I'm going to do this and everyone's going to mess up and then have to come back to me, even if what happens in the end happens in the end. But it's still really great, even though she kind of, there's a great moment of her being a bit too hubris about it. And that's when everything falls apart. But she is so good in this.
Yeah, definitely.
And with that, we are going to get on to the main event, Brian De Palma's Femme Fatale.
From director Brian De Palma, master of the erotic thriller, comes a new suspense sensation.
This top supermodel's wearing more than you'd think. 10 million in diamonds.
This isn't a game tonight. People can die. Remember, no names and no guns.
Go.
The witch double-crossed us. She ran away with the diamonds.
A little under 4 million.
Not bad for a night's work, huh?
Where are the diamonds?
It's Johnny.
I know who you are.
You know who Bruce Hewitt Watts is?
The new American ambassador?
He's got a wife, but no one seems to have a picture of her.
So you want me to nail her, right?
Nicholas Bardo?
Speaking.
You took a picture of Mrs. Watts?
But
I don't think you realize who you're dealing with, Mr. Bardo. We know all about you.
I have a past here. It only takes one photo.
Are you flirting with me?
Baby, there's one more thing we gotta do.
She set me up for you guys to get me out of the way.
That's what it's all about. Me disappearing.
Patrick, when was the first time you saw this movie?
I saw it opening night back in 2002 because it was a new Brian De Palma movie. That's all that mattered to me. And it had been a while since I had like fully loved a Brian De Palma movie the way that I wanted to. Like, I liked things about Mission to Mars. I enjoyed Mission Impossible. Snake Eyes felt close to the kind of De Palma movie that I really respond to, but doesn't totally stick the landing, even though it's got Nicolas Cage in it. But Femme Fatale was like, oh, this is De Palma doing like his great 80s thrillers kind of stuff. And for me, I'm glad he continues to make movies and continues to work. This, for me, would have been a perfect movie for him to go out on, because I really do feel like it's in so many ways the kind of sum total of everything he's been talking about throughout his career. This is sort of the ultimate Brian De Palma movie.
It really is, because I just watched it yesterday for the first time and I'd heard, it's his greatest hits. And it is. I mean, there are some amazing references back to his earlier movies, say with Dressed to Kill and that kind of thing. But then you're watching it and it's just, it feels like him. Yeah, it feels like his a swan song in a way, because it's the culmination of everything he's done, especially with his 80 thrillers, all come into one. He's taken kind of that opening from Snake Eyes and then does it even more fluidly and more broader in Femme Fatale. And it's kind of, it's the most movie of movies, is the only way I can think of describing it, because it feels like such a movie. Everything about it is artificial. Everything about it is, every camera shot lets you know, oh no, this is a movie. This is not a reality that you can sink into. And you just sit there and I'm just like, oh yeah, this is what Brian De Palma does when he's not restrained by anything. I'm not saying he was completely restrained on Snake Eyes, because that feels like a very Brian De Palma movie. But this kind of took that to the new extra heights. Like, I think with this coming out, I still hadn't quite connected the dots with De Palma yet. Like, I'd seen Mission Impossible, I'd seen Mission to Mars, I'd Snake Eyes, but I hadn't quite figured out that was the same guy yet. So watching, so coming back and watching this, I was like, oh, so this is kind of what everything was leading up to, almost. So yeah, this would have been the perfect movie to end on. I mean, that opening is perfect.
It is. It's, I like it better than the opening of Snake Eyes. I know the opening of Snake Eyes is more probably famous because it kind of pulls off the, even though it's not a, an actual single take, it looks like a single take, and you have the wild performance of Nicolas Cage kind of driving it. And that opening kind of dominates the conversation around that entire movie. Like, people don't really talk about that movie except to talk about the opening, and oh, the opening's so great, and the rest of the movie's kind of like meh. But I think the whole opening at Cannes in Femme Fatale is a lot stronger, even if it's not trying to pull off the whole single take thing.
No, and it's more, it kind of does this build. I mean, with Snake Eyes, it just starts off big because it is Nick Cage starting at 11 and then kind of going from there, even though I love his performance in that movie. This is much more subdued. Like, you have start off with Romaine lying on the bed, watching Double Indemnity. She doesn't, you don't really see her full face until way later in the movie. Like, it keeps kind of hiding her, whether she's taking a photo, whether she's looking to the side, whether she's looking at a screen. And then it just keeps building. And then her first line doesn't come into like 15 minutes, but it's, I think it's like, leave her alone, or you know, I can't remember what the line is, but it's kind of like, oh, here she is. And it's these kind of shots from every single side of her, except her like full shot, which is really clever.
Yeah. Yeah. He was really clever, I think, in casting her. And I know he took a chance, because at this point she had done X-Men, but she was mostly known as a model. And I know he got some pushback for her casting. There's I don't know what the hell this, there's something on the Wikipedia page about the Stinkers Bad Movie Awards, which I've never heard of. I've heard of like the Golden Turkeys, I've heard of the Razzies, I've never heard of the Stinkers, but they nominated him for worst director and her for worst actress, I know, which is just ludicrous on both counts, but whatever.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, he's going for this sort of the iconography of the icy blonde.
Yes.
And could have just as easily cast, you know, Sharon Stone, who could do something like this in her sleep. But I think he taps into something with her. In particular, the scene where she kind of gives the guy the lap dance, and I'm jumping way ahead and I apologize.
Oh, no, please do.
The scene where she kind of gives the guy the lap dance, and then Antonio Banderas starts beating him up. The shift that she does from being very sort of feminine and seductive and using her body in a very sexualized way, and then as soon as the fight starts, she takes this almost masculine position as she's sitting down. She kind of pops her leg up and she hunches over and she's like kind of smiling and laughing at the fight going on. And it's such a great turn, and it encompasses such a complex character who is so many things at one time. And that was the moment, honestly, that I was like, oh, wow, Rebecca Romijn is really doing something special in this movie. I mean, she's so captivating for the whole movie. But that was the moment where I was like, oh, she really is locked into who this character is in a really interesting way. And I just think it should have led to a really big movie career. Again, she's doing fine. Nobody has to worry about Rebecca Romijn. Like, she's got a career and a family, and she's very happy, and everything's great for her. I just really felt like this should have led to big things for her, and I applaud De Palma for taking the risk in casting her.
I know. I did read somewhere that they were going to cast Uma Thurman at one stage, who would have also... Okay,
that makes sense. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that would have been... She would have been great in it because Uma's great. But yeah, you're right. That switch is amazing. And she does it kind of throughout the movie. Like, it's these different shades of what a femme fatale is. It's the icy blonde. It's the mysterious when she's wearing the scarf and she's with... she's playing Antonia Banderas because she's trying to set up a kidnapping kind of thing. So she's right. Kind of being that mysterious woman. And then she's the hypersexual femme fatale when she's giving the lap dance. And then all of a sudden she's the cunning, I'm going to shoot my husband. So I make sure I get the 10 million. It's these changing sort of personalities that go through the movie. And it's really well done that you don't always notice them happening, because the way Brian shoots her and is shooting the movie, that it is... anything could kind of happen, and you don't know who she's going to be at any given point. And it's you're right. When she's sitting on the table and watching the fight, and she suddenly, her posture completely changes. She is very locked into who this character is and to kind of the different personalities that she's presenting on screen. It's a really kind of cool performance, and you're just watching it going, oh, okay. So who is the real Rebecca? Who is the real Laurie? Yeah. I guess is you never quite know. Even at the end, when she makes the choice after she wakes up in the bathtub, you're never quite sure exactly who that person is exactly, because she can just be any different kind of person at any given time, and that's what I love about the movie.
And the De Palma doesn't necessarily do her any favors in terms of, like, A, the movie is called Femme Fatale, so we know that she's just playing almost an archetype. And it opens with the most famous femme fatale of all time. It's Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity.
Yes.
She's watching Double Indemnity on TV. And so it's like you're immediately invited to draw comparisons between Rebecca Romijn and Barbara Stanwyck. And that's just unfair to anybody, because nobody's going to live up to what Barbara Stanwyck does in Double Indemnity. And no. I remember some critics at the time calling attention to that, like, well, she's no Barbara Stanwyck. Well, no one is. Come on.
That is very true. No one can be Barbara Stanwyck, especially in Double Indemnity. That is kind of an unfair comparison.
Yes. How do you feel about the whole it was a dream thing?
I actually kind of liked it, and I think it worked in this movie actually really well. I think I knew about that, which is why I thought I'd seen it, so I knew it was coming. But I think it kind of does work for what the movie's trying to do, because everything from the get-go feels very artificial. So I didn't mind it, actually. I thought it kind of worked. I'm not entirely the whole she can see the future thing, I'm not entirely sure how I feel about yet. That's just going to take a few more viewings of it. But yeah, because everything is kind of filmed very dreamlike. Like, De Palma's never been a subtle director, so he's always going to always sort of present things as he wants you to see them. And he's like, yeah, no, this is a dream. This is what is happening is ludicrous on screen. You know this. But it does work, especially when she's in the water, when she falls into the water and she kind of has that realization and then pops up from the bath. I do love that sequence a lot.
Yeah, it's very striking. I remember at the time feeling a little cheated, like, oh, it's a dream. And then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, no, exactly like you said, where it's all a movie. Movies are dreams. De Palma is in complete control, and he's the one who's going to say, like, no, this is actually the ending that I want for Laura. And it becomes almost a choose your own adventure where he gets to reinvent her life because he's the filmmaker and he's the one calling the shots. Just as she's the one calling the shots in the narrative and she's able to sort of seize control of her life, he's, you know, kind of the overseer of the whole thing. And so it's a movie about being a movie. And so I'm okay with the, it's a dream. In almost any other movie, it would bother me.
Oh yeah. I remember, well, spoilers for a 1944 movie, but the Fritz Lang, the woman in the window has that exact same ending. And Fritz Lang does it so well. Like you're so stressed for Edward G. Robinson because you just don't know how he's going to get out of a situation that he's found himself in, thanks to a woman in the window. And then he just suddenly pops back awake and it's just like, oh, okay. So it was just a dream then? Oh, right. Okay. I finished that movie. Even though I do love that movie, that ending always kind of had me like, ah, oh, okay, fine. You were just asleep in your club. That's okay. What do you think of, Antonio Banderas, of course, can just match Rebecca Romijn in beauty, but what do you think of his performance, especially because he has to try on a different personality at one point?
Yeah, I mean, he's good. He's always good. I've never seen Antonio Banderas like phone it in. Mm. I find him, and it's not any fault of his performance, because I do think, like you said, he's trying to sort of match her pound for pound, but I do think he ends up getting wiped off the screen a little bit just by the construction of the movie. He doesn't have like a much of a part to play. He's kind of photographer who is trying to do the right thing and is lusting after her, or is, you know, is interested in her. She dominates to such a degree, I think, which works for the movie, but it almost could have been any actor.
You're right. He is just more of a piece of the puzzle, I think, than anything else. Where there's Romijn is the whole movie. I mean, as you've said, it is shot around her. Where there's Banderas's role, he's just another kind of piece in that puzzle. Like you see him at the beginning when he first takes a photo of her. Then it's the 7 years later after the events in Lily's house happen. And then it's him back on the thing. He's just part of the dream. He's part of the creation of the movie. He doesn't necessarily matter, even though when you're looking at two beautiful people on screen, I just think they have chemistry regardless if they do or don't, because I'm just like, ah, they're both really hot. And yeah.
Absolutely. And that's a big, you know, I'm sure it's a big part of why he cast Antonio Banderas. Why Antonio Banderas gets top billing will forever confuse me, because that's, I think, just Hollywood sexism. But
yeah,
he's a beautiful person. And so to put beautiful people on screen is, again, De Palma saying, like, that's part of the function of movies, is to look at beautiful people, to look at people who are larger than life. And here are two of the most beautiful people, and I'm just going to put them in a scene together.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, and he does that often. And they are insanely good looking together, even though, I think, yeah, you're right, Romijn completely dominates. But am I wrong in thinking when they're sort of putting the posters up, especially when before the forgot her name woman in the camo kind of shorts gets hit by the car, you're seeing these art posters, and it's actually Romijn's face as well in those? Or was I imagining things?
Well, in the one time, the posters are the picture that Antonio Banderas took of her, like, getting out of the limo.
Yes. And then I saw one of an art show, and I thought I saw Romijn's face in one of the paintings on the maybe poster. Yeah. It, I don't know. It was a flash. I could have been imagining it just because I was probably in the whole, oh, everything's kind of like constructed and everything's kind of like not a meaning, but like a thing. Because every time you see the cityscape of Paris, it's like a photo of Paris on a wall, which I absolutely love. As soon as I saw that, I'm like, oh, that is such a good idea. I love you, Brian. It's so good. this movie just keeps doing that over and over again. And it just kind of, the more it goes on, the more kind of, I don't know, almost Eurotrash it felt. Maybe it's because she's giving a striptease in a skeezy bar to a guy in leather.
Yeah.
And that kind of redness. But it did, I'm like, oh, we're going into early 2000s Eurotrash. Yeah, I am very, very happy.
It's a fun scene, and it's kind of where the movie, you know, leans into, I think, some of that seediness and sleaziness that De Palma can be known for a little bit. I mean, there's certainly in the opening sequence too, when he's having the two women make out in the stall and he's got the overhead camera on them and stuff. I mean, it's that voyeurism that De Palma is so known for. And then there's an element of voyeurism even during the lap dance, because some of what we're watching is it play out on Antonio Banderas's face, and we've got that amazing split diopter shot of the man that she's dancing for, whose name I can't remember, Igor or something crazy like that, and then Antonio Banderas in the background. So we have like two levels of voyeurism, plus the third level being us in the audience watching the faces of these two men. It's just, there's so much going on in this movie. I love it.
There is, and I love the split diopters in that scene, because it is really just reinforcing of, oh, you're watching a movie, and you're watching, you know, Igor and Banderas watching
Igor, there we go,
Igor or something, watching Romain. It's kind of incredible, and he keeps doing it throughout the movie. It's, I don't know, even the scene when Lily, the other Rebecca Romijn, kills herself, and you have Laurie in the closet or the wardrobe, just kind of watching her and not deciding what she's going to do. It's, again, it builds up to that voyeurism of everyone's watching something else, whether it's a screen, whether it's a poster, whether it's a movie at Cannes, the fact that it's set at Cannes and everyone's watching a movie when all this other stuff is happening, and everyone's watching security cameras and all this other kind of stuff. It's just, it's kind of the ultimate who's watching who movie. And I know Brian De Palma's done this so often in like Body Double, Dressed to Kill, even Scarface, it pops up again. It happens so constantly, but this one just kind of feels the most unfiltered of it all.
Yeah. Did you see the De Palma documentary?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
I can't remember if they talked about it in the documentary, if it was in a book that I read, but they talk about him as a kid trying to catch his father in the act of cheating on his mom and like taking pictures, following his dad around and taking pictures. And when I heard that story, I was like, oh my gosh, all the voyeurism in his movies just took on this whole new level of meaning, and like it makes so much sense now. It's so wild.
Yeah, they do talk about it in the documentary. He's very matter of fact about it from memory. Yeah. He's like, yeah, I wanted to catch my dad cheating, and so I did. And it does take on this whole new meaning, because that's now how he sees the world. It's about watching almost, and seeing kind of the world, a reality he didn't know about, present itself, which I guess is his father having the affair, but it's kind of repeated over and over again in his movies. And yeah, when you watch Femme Fatale, I mean, I love Body Double, the whole conceit of it, of this, of what's his name, watching Melanie Griffith, who doesn't know is Melanie Griffith, dancing in a bedroom naked, right, and then seeing her in the porn movie. It's this amazing kind of how realities can shift just by purely by what you've seen or what you think you've seen. And well, that is Femme Fatale.
Even the choice to make Antonio Banderas a photographer whose career goal at the moment is to catch a picture of Rebecca Romijn sort of in the act of existing, just to prove like, here she is, she's still alive. It becomes a sort of a personal choice, you know, for De Palma because of his background.
It really, really does. And the fact that you have Rebecca Romijn posing as a photographer at the beginning when they're doing the heist at Cannes, and so you can't quite see her face, but you can tell that she's taking a photo of the model. I didn't write her name down. I apologize.
No, I didn't either.
but that was a hell of a, I did not realize that was what was being stolen. I'm like going, that is a hell of an outfit. But it is, she's taking photos of her, which is the first time she sees her. So when she kind of propositions her to go to the bathroom, it's this, it's sort of amazing thing. It's again, what you see and how you see, what lens you see it through completely shifts the reality. And which is, I guess I keep going back to body double, because that's what body double literally
is.
Is how you see something through what lens, whether it's through a telescope or through a camera or through a TV. And this is, the fact that it's about Khan and they sort of work in the paparazzi or the photographers, I think was a really smart move, because it captures that that kind of almost celebrity moment, and how Rebecca Romijn, it's really thinking on her being a model, because it's all about how people take photos of her, and it works better because she does have that background as a model and knows how to hold herself as such. And she's constantly doing that throughout the movie.
If I have one nitpick about the movie, it's that their whole plan to steal this expensive diamond, I don't even know what you would call it. It's not, I guess they keep referring to it as a necklace. It seems very elaborate. You have people like rappelling down tunnels, and you have lots of people looking at security cameras. But ultimately it comes down to like, Rebecca Romijn, you make out with her and we'll do the switch-o change-o under the bathroom stall. Like, it's the most simplistic, like you or I could pull off that heist.
Yeah. And the fact that, well, Rebecca Romijn is definitely hot enough to go, yeah, take off your necklace outfit for me. And she's like, yeah, sure. This is great. She has security guards following her around. But yeah, it is really simplistic, which is why I love it when it goes so wrong. Yeah, because it goes wrong. When it goes wrong, it goes wrong really, really quickly. All of a sudden, people think they don't know which thing they're switching over. They don't know all that kind of thing. And it's, but it is such a simple plan. It's literally get this girl to take it off. We'll do the switch and no one will know. And then it goes, nope, everyone knows straight away now. That did not go according to plan at all.
And in keeping with the spirit of the movie, we find out that that's not even reality either, that she was sort of in on it with the model and it was a whole, you know. So even though I have that little nitpick, that it's not a very valid criticism, because as we later find out, the two were in on it together.
Exactly. So it's just again that shifting reality that Brian does so well. It actually took me a minute to figure that out, because when she's first killed, which is killed in the movie, not the first time, because she survives the second time, when she's hit by the truck, it's kind of fascinating moment. I'm like, wait, what? What's? Oh, she. Yeah, and then I had to rewind and go, oh, wait, that's her. She's doing. Yeah, okay. Now I've kind of got it. The way he films it is purposely to kind of get you confused as to what's going on. And then when you see the scene again, you're like, oh, okay. I was a bit slow, but now I know what's going on. And in typical Brian De Palma fashion, those two guys' death at the end of it, Edward Montal and Eric Ebony, I think, butchering those French names, that death is spectacular.
Oh, it's brutal. It's really something.
It's amazing. Like, he's already set it up. Like, because beforehand, she's already just hit by the truck and that's the end of it. And then when you get to the second way of doing it, they are just impaled and just blood everywhere. It's glorious.
And it's up until that point, it's like the only thing missing from the movie is some of that Brian De Palma ultraviolence.
Yes.
Because I always joke that like Femme Fatale is a movie that has everything you could want from a movie. And up until that moment, it doesn't get very violent. And De Palma does violence so well. So when we get those two guys getting impaled and just the amount of blood that we see, it is very satisfying.
It is so satisfying, mainly because from the beginning, you do not like Eric. He is slapping Romijn around. He is really heavy-handed. He brings the gun when he's not meant to bring the gun. You can tell he's got very organized. Again, not a very good, well, Rebecca Romijn had this all planned, so he was never going to get the diamonds in the first place. But he's kind of that guy who thinks he's smarter than he actually is. So to see that satisfying death, it's just like, there he is. There's Brian. Someone's gotten impaled. this movie's just doing so many things on so many different levels that I love. And I love the references, mainly because I've just seen Sisters for the first time. The whole, oh, you can pick up my prescription, it'll be fine. I'm like, oh, I've seen that movie.
And we get a Greg Henry sighting from
Yes.
Body double and Scarface and Casualties of War. I mean, he's one of De Palma's favorite guys. So it's so great to see him show up in the movie, too.
I love him when he shows up. Yeah, you're right. He shows up in a lot of Brian De Palma, and it's always a welcome thing because he's always being... He's being extra Southern in this movie with that twang. And I really, really like it. He's just like, no, you will bring that photo to me right now. You do not realize who this is.
He shows up again in The Black Dahlia a couple of years later, which is like a De Palma movie that I want to love so much. I'm not quite there. I like what he's doing as a director, but the movie as a whole doesn't totally work for me. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have. Well, I haven't seen it since 2006. And
okay,
I remember wanting to like it, but it just doesn't quite work because it's got all the flair of De Palma from memory, but there's something missing. Yeah. But I need to go back and revisit it because, I literally haven't seen it since 2006.
Okay.
Yeah. So I remember kind of like there were things I liked about it, but then I'm like, I do need to go back and visit it. So I'll have to revisit to see what's actually going on with that. All I really remember is Josh Hartnett.
I Scarlett Johansson and Hilary Swank like probably should have switched places. Mm. And there's a lot of things that maybe could have fixed it. There's some great De Palma directing flourishes going on, but the movie as a whole is kind of like Mission to Mars, where it's like, this is like 55% of the way there.
I remember like Mission to Mars, but there was two movies that came, that Mars movies. It was the Mars year.
Red Planet, was that the other one?
Yeah. I remember going and seeing both of them. So I think I've got them both in my brain. So I can't always remember which is which, even though with Brian De Palma, I thought I would have been able to remember it. It was the one with, now it's the one with Tim Robbins. Now I remember which one this is. Yeah. Because it was Red Planet, which I think had Jerry O'Connell and all. I remember going to see both of them. I remember going, this feels like a lot of Mars going on. Like Dante's Peak in Volcano.
That's right.
Again, both I saw in the movie theater. Like as soon as there was like a big kind of double kind of thing, I was like, yes, let's go see this. Armageddon and... what was the other one for Morgan Freeman?
Deep Impact.
Deep Impact, yeah. I had to do both of those at the same... They always were at the same time, I remember, as well. It was like they came out right after the other.
Yeah. I still have never seen Deep Impact. I feel bad about that. But I have seen Armageddon.
Yeah, Armageddon is hard to... Actually, Armageddon has kind of overtaken it because it's such a hard movie to forget, mainly because they just does not stop moving the camera. anything else you want to say about Femme Fatale?
Just, I love it. I would put it probably in my top five De Palmas, but don't ask me what the other four are, because I don't know if I could do that right now. I think it's like a really underrated De Palma movie. I'm kind of hoping that this new Shout Factory Blu-ray gets some eyes on the movie, because I think it's very overlooked, and I think... De Palma's movies are not for everyone, but if you are a fan of him as a filmmaker at all, you owe it to yourself to see this movie because it really is, as you said, his greatest hits. It's such a fantastic movie.
It is. I didn't realize a Shout Factory Blu-ray was coming up. That's amazing because I hope it does get more eyes on it because I think it does get forgotten a little bit because it is in the 2000s and everyone wants to go back and remember the glorious 80s. When there's so much going on in this, but no, that is absolutely fantastic. It is such a great movie with so many shades of just different styles in it. Like one minute you're in Hitchcock, the next minute you're in again more sort of a Euro kind of thriller, the next minute you're in this kind of Wizard of Oz, it was all a dream that actually kind of works. It gets very surreal and very dreamlike, which I always love in a movie. I love it when a movie doesn't pretend it's not a movie or just like, yeah, this is a movie. You're going to have to deal with it as it is. And we haven't even mentioned Peter Coyote, who doesn't have actually much of a role, but I was just happy that he showed up.
Yeah, I just saw E.T. again like a week ago, and he's so good in that movie in such a small role that seeing him show up again in Femme Fatale, I was like, oh, Peter Coyote, you're very welcome here.
Yeah, I actually remember an interview he was talking about E.T., and he sounded more excited than the kids about it. It was just, he sounded like a big kid, which is kind of fair enough, but the kids were like, yeah, it was a movie I was in, and he was like, I was in E.T., guys, do you know how cool that is? It's like, yeah, I do, Peter Coyote, you're amazing. Yeah, it's just a movie of many textures. You've got people popping up that you always like to see, like Greg Henry and Peter Coyote, and of course Banderas. But it's just this amazing, gorgeous movie that just kind of, I don't know, it tickles you. It's just so much fun. And yeah, I can't wait to watch it again, because I know it's one of those movies I'm going to notice more and more things as I watch it.
Yeah, I think so. This was probably only my third or fourth time seeing it, and I feel like I picked up on new stuff every time.
Yeah, and I can see why it would be in a top five De Palma, though. I know the top five of that kind of De Palma can change just regularly depending on what you've just kind of watched. He's one of those directors.
Definitely.
So I was sort of going, oh, man, Mission Impossible is really, actually, maybe that's in my top five. And now I've watched Femme Fatale, I'm like, ooh, okay, Femme Fatale is really good. So it always it always depends on, yeah, my favorite De Palma movie is often which one I've just seen.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Thank you so much for coming on. This was a blast of a conversation. This double was so much fun, considering it was literally The Witch and the Femme Fatale. It's a kind of a great way of just distilling those kind of archetypes, and then just Rebecca Romijn just kind of killing it in both instances. But before we go, please tell people where they can find your good work.
Oh gosh. I have a website and a podcast called F This Movie. That's at fthismovie.com. And I'm on Twitter at Patrick Bromley.
Yes, please follow both. If This Movie is such a great podcast, I've been listening to it for years, so this is a little surreal actually talking to you, because I've been listening to you for so long. But yeah, just a note, Scary Movie Month is coming up very, very soon, which is an absolutely amazing time of year, because you just get to watch all the scary movies. And it's just a celebration of weird, quirky, weird movies that you like and or just love. So I'm really looking forward to Scary Movie Month. And you always have like the best month planned, so I know you're probably working very hard on that, going, oh my god, what am I gonna do this year?
Yeah, absolutely. This is about the time where that starts to set in, like, oh boy, I better figure this out.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. Please,
thank you so much,
listen to F This Movie. It is one of the greats. Again, if you want to shock and awe one at Twitter and Instagram, and then I'm at Reading Geek on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back with another double feature. All right, thanks, guys. Bye.